So how do we treat any offers? At what point in the gospel is the plan to get rid of Jesus hatched in Mark? Any offers? Chapter 3, Craig. Very good. Chapter 3 and verse 6. 79 verses into the gospel, we read this. The Pharisees went out and immediately held counsel with the Herodians against Jesus, how to destroy him. Things have barely got off the ground, have they? And yet here we have two groups who are humanly opposed to each other, the Pharisees and the Herodians, one very secular, the Herodians, one religious, the Pharisees. Together, they see Jesus as an enemy, the enemy. And so from the beginning of chapter 3, they are working on their plan to get rid of him. And so if we come back to chapter 15, we have the chief priests holding consultation with the elders and scribes and the whole council. Mark is very keen to show us that everybody is involved. They are all working together to reject Jesus as king. But of course, this isn't just the plan of sinful, rebellious humanity. This is also God's plan. Next slide, Alex, please. This is what we read in Psalm 2. Why do the nations rage and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us burst their bonds apart and cast away their cords from us. Humanity has always thought they would be freer without God's intervention and interference. And so the rulers plot against God and have always done so. In the Acts of the Apostles, when the apostles are being threatened, they look back to Psalm 2 to understand what's been going on in Jerusalem in the preceding weeks. And then Isaiah 53, talking of the suffering servant. He was oppressed, he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth like a lamb that is led to the slaughter, and like a sheep that before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away. And as for his generation, who consider that he was cut off out of the land of the living, stricken for the transgression of my people? And so it is that Jesus refuses to answer the charge laid against him. And so it is that the rulers of the peoples of the world, by oppression and judgment, take him away. Thanks, Alex. So there is a plan from sinful humanity since chapter 3. This is God's plan from before the very beginning. And Jesus acknowledges and acquiesces to and goes along with and submits to and embraces this plan. Three times in the gospel, he says what is going to happen. He's going to Jerusalem. He will be betrayed. He will be tried. He will be crucified and he will rise again. Glance back to verse 49 of chapter 14. In the Garden of Gethsemane, he says, day after day I was with you in the temple teaching, and you did not seize me, but let the scriptures be fulfilled. Jesus is submitting willingly to his Father's will. And let me just add a sort of a footnote at this moment. Back in the summer, I had the privilege of being in the Garden of Gethsemane. And they say that there are some olive trees there that would have been there when Jesus was there. But the amazing thing about the Garden of Gethsemane is that it's on the lower slopes of the Mount of Olives. You can see the city of Jerusalem. It's night, don't forget. You'd have seen the torches coming out of Jerusalem, down the hill into the valley, and then up to the garden. Had Jesus wished, he could very easily have escaped and just gone back up of the hill, over the Mount of Olives, to the village of Bethany. Nothing would have been easier. He'd have been away long before the arrest party arrived. But he submits to this plan. He waits, because this has been God's plan from before the very beginning. Pilate can't quite get his head around what's going on. He says, "Have you no answer to the charge? See how many charges they bring against you." But Jesus made no further answer, so that Pilate was amazed. He's amazed that Jesus makes no defense. He's amazed at his silence. Maybe he's amazed that Jesus refuses to use the power of his words that he'd heard about. Back in chapter 12, nobody had dared to ask Jesus any more questions because of the way in which he had dealt with his accusers there. And we should join Pilate in his amazement. We should join Pilate at the king who chose this way. We should join Pilate in amazement that Jesus was willing to see it through to the very bitter end. And we should fall at his feet in gratitude. But of course, as we do that, we must take into account the fact that following such a king as Jesus will not be easy. Take into account the fact that religion and state will continue to oppose him, his gospel, and so his people. And we recognize the way in which that has happened throughout history and is happening throughout the world today. And as things get tougher for us in this country, we join with his brothers and sisters around the world and through history in joyful praise and thanksgiving to King Jesus, who did indeed see it through to the end, who felt the full force of such opposition, but triumphed over it. The king is challenged by the rulers of the world. Secondly, then, the king is rejected by the peoples of the world. That's verses 6 to 15. And here, humanity chooses evil over good. And of course, we wonder, how could this have happened? Have a look at verse 11. Pilate's asked, "Do you want me to release for you the king of the Jews?" For he perceived it was out of envy that the chief priests had delivered him up. But the chief priests stirred up the crowd to have him release for them Barabbas instead. What on earth did the people have against Jesus? How is it that they are so easily swayed? Next slide, please, Alex. Well, to a certain extent, Jesus has given us the answer back in chapter 7. You see, it's not just the rulers of humanity who conspire against God. All of us have hearts that are programmed to reject God, that prefer our own freedom and our own way, that are in rebellion against him. So Jesus said, "What comes out of a person is what defiles him. For from within, out of the heart of man, come evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, coveting, wickedness, deceit, sensuality, envy, slander, pride, foolishness. All these evil things come from within, and they defile a person." Foolishness? It's the fool who says in his heart, "There is no God." Humanity is fatally flawed. We will always reject God. We are in rebellion against him. And so it should not surprise us that on this day, the crowd shout for Barabbas. Notice how he's described in verse 7. Among the rebels in prison who had committed murder in insurrection, there was a man called Barabbas. He's a rebel, he's a murderer, he's an insurrectionist. He is, verse 14, evil. And they choose him over against Jesus. Described in verses 9 and 12 as king of the Jews. Verse 14, Pilate said to them, "Why, what evil has he done?" Jesus is innocent. Even Pilate knows there is no guilt in him. But Pilate is as guilty as the Jewish leaders. Pilate is as guilty as the crowds. He is guilty in his weakness, whereas they are guilty in their willfulness. They will have Jesus dead. And yet Pilate fails to prevent this great injustice. Maybe the greatest injustice of all history. Thanks, Alex, and take that away now. And we might understand why Pilate feels under pressure, why Pilate gives in to their demands. It is festival time. The city is absolutely rammed. There's that rather sort of uneasy atmosphere in the place at such a time. Populist uprisings, the fervor of possibilities. And Pilate's had problems before in such situations. He knows he's got very little rope with the Jewish leaders. He knows they have already complained to his masters in Rome about him. He needs to keep them on side. And so it is that humanity together, Jew and Gentile together, choose to crucify their king, choose to opt for evil in the place of God. And yet in the midst of this injustice, we cannot fail to see the wonder of God's plan worked out, can we? As we look at Barabbas and we look at Jesus, we see that the innocent dies in the place of the guilty. We see that the guilty walks away to live. And we see that as judgment must fall on one, it falls on this one, here in Jerusalem on that day and on the final day of judgment. We'll know the full force of the one dying for the people. So here is the gospel in all its glory. This king lays down his life for the people. The innocent king gives his life for the guilty. Here's the plan of God laid out publicly so that all can see. Have you seen? Maybe if it's not clear yet, ask God to open your eyes that you will see. Have you yet embraced the freedom which Christ has won for you when he died in your place? If not, ask him to help you to do that. Or maybe you're still with the crowds. You're still shouting, "Crucify." So you will either be for God or for evil. You'll either be for life or for death. You'll either be for freedom or for slavery. So let's embrace the rejected king. Let's rejoice at the victory he won through his suffering and his death. The king is rejected by the people. And then in verses 16 to 20, the king is mocked by the world. The soldiers led him away inside the palace, and they called together the whole battalion. And they clothed him in a purple cloak, and twisting together a crown of thorns, they put it on him. And they began to salute him, "Hail, King of the Jews." And they were striking his head with a reed and spitting on him and kneeling down in homage to him. And when they'd mocked him, they stripped him of the purple cloak and put his own clothes on him. And then they led him out to crucify him. Here we have the cruelty of banter, the cruelty of kicking a man when he's down. These soldiers would have been from the surrounding nations. That was the way in which the Romans did it. And seeing weakness, they're exploiting that weakness. Seeing vulnerability, they're enjoying making the most of it. And we will have played our part in such things, I'm sure, or maybe been on the receiving end, because we know there is something in the human psyche that always seeks to exploit vulnerability and weakness. You can think, I'm sure, about the one who always gets picked on at school, in the classroom, in the playing field, the one who's the butt of all the jokes in the office or the dressing room. Now, previously in the chapter, we saw the way in which Mark made it very clear that the whole council was involved. And here he makes the point in verse 16 that it's the whole battalion. Everybody is involved. You see, we like to think, don't we, that we're not really like that. Yes, please, picture please, Alex. We like to think that those words we spoke or what we did, well, it was a minor aberration. This is a guy called Cash Alley. He's a boxer. He was boxing last weekend, and he got disqualified. He got disqualified for biting his opponent. This is what he said afterwards. "My behavior on Saturday during the fight was not a true reflection of who I am." That's what people always say, isn't it? When a footballer makes a bad tackle, the manager always comes on and says, "Oh, well, of course, he's not really like that." That's what we say, isn't it? Or in other circumstances, we hear talk of a few bad apples. So, I couldn't resist a line of duty picture. You'll all be home in time, I promise you. AC-12, that's what they're there for, to root out the few bad apples. But what is Mark doing here? Mark's challenging us. Thanks, Alex. Remove. Mark is saying to us, let's not pretend. This is what we are really like. This is what we are all really like. The whole council, the whole battalion, Jew and Gentile together. And so they clothe Jesus in the robes and the crown. They strike him, they spit, and kneeling before him, they mock him. Now, I wonder, as you read those words in verse 19 particularly, I wonder which of those things it is that strikes you most. Which is the one that is the worst of those things? Well, there's no doubt that in the world of sport these days, the one that stands out above all else is spitting. This was the sports columnist Paul McInnes in January last year. A few years away, gobbing is back, effortlessly renewing its position as the number one most offensive act in football. It does seem odd, though, that spitting should be so vilified when other not entirely dissimilar activities are barely even noticed. Foul language, for example, is surely more wounding of a victim and is very much seen by impressionable young fans watching on TV. Now, the ban for the spitting offence, which Paul McInnes is referring to, was 6 weeks. The equivalent, the only equivalent ban for a non-spitting offence within UEFA was for eye gouging. Interesting, isn't it? The world of rugby is much the same. Daniel Schofield wrote this in January this year. When Harlequins hooker Dave Ward was simultaneously accused of treading on the ankle of Thomas Young, as well as spitting towards him, there was no doubt which was considered the more heinous offence. It was Ward's alleged mouth-borne projectile that had the Twitter lynch mobs yielding multiple exclamation marks as pitchforks. Hanging, apparently, was too good for Ward. So, almost breaking somebody's ankle by stamping on it is not as serious as spitting. Interesting, isn't it? Spitting is the thing. Now, as you read that list in verse 19, I wonder if you came to the same conclusion. So the question is, will you spit on Jesus? Or will you be spat on for being with Jesus? It's one or the other. There's no neutral ground where Jesus is concerned. Will you be prepared to suffer the mockery, the degradation, the pain, the humiliation that Jesus suffered? Chances are you've already experienced it at school or at work among friends. Maybe you've had that moment when somebody's found out you're a Christian and they're just sort of deflated. Oh, I thought you were so much better than that. You mean you're one of those? You think all that sort of stuff? Well, when that happens, just remember the one who's gone before you. When that happens, remember all that he took before us and rejoice that he was willing to do that for us. Jesus is mocked by the world. Yes, please, Alex. Jesus then is the king. The king who dies for the people. The king who gives his life to ransom others. The king who comes to serve through suffering. Is he the king you've bowed the knee to? Will you bow the knee to this king? And if you have bowed the knee to this king, are you willing to suffer with him? Are you willing to experience the shame and the mockery we've been thinking about tonight? We're called on to fall down before him. We're called on to acknowledge him as Lord. We're called on to give ourselves in praise and thanksgiving for such a king, the true king of all.